The only lights came from a single brass carriage lamp dangling over the front door. I already knew that Wick Sachs had a wife and two small children. His wife was a registered nurse at Duke University Hospital. The FBI had checked her credentials. She had an excellent reputation, and everyone spoke very highly of her. The Sachs's daughter, Faye Ann, was 7, and their son Nathan was 10. I figured that the FBI was probably watching me as I drove up to the Sachs's house, but I didn't much care. I wondered if Kyle Craig was with them. He was deeply involved in the grisly case, almost as much as I was. Kyle had also gone to Duke. Was this case personal for him, too? How personal? My eyes very slowly ran up and down the front of the house, then along the well-tended grounds. Everything was extremely orderly, actually quite beautiful, perfect as could be. I had already learned that human monsters can live anywhere, that some of the clever ones chose ordinary, all-American-looking houses, just like the house I was examining now. The monsters are literally everywhere. There is an epidemic running out of control in America, and the statistics are frightening. We have nearly 75% of the human hunters. Europe has almost all the rest, led by England, Germany, and France. Mass murderers are changing the face of modern homicide investigations in every American city, village, and town. I studied everything I could about the house's exterior. The southeast side had what was known as a Florida room. There was a patio, which was living room size. The lawn was fescue, and it was extremely well kept. There was no moss, no crabgrass, no weeds. The cobbled brick walkway from the driveway was carefully edged, and not a single stray blade of grass peeked through the stones. The bricks of the walk perfectly matched the bricks of the house. Perfect. Meticulous. As I sat in the car, my head was pounding from too much tension and stress. I kept the motor running in case the family Sachs suddenly came home. I knew what I wanted to do, what I had to do, what I'd been planning to do for the last few hours. I needed to break into his house. I wondered if the FBI would try to stop me, but I didn't think they would. I believed that maybe they actually wanted me to break inside and look around. We knew very little about Dr. Wick Sachs. I still wasn't officially involved in the Casanova manhunt, and I could try things that the others couldn't. I was supposed to be the loose cannon. That was my deal with Kyle Craig. Scoochie was out there someplace. At least I prayed that she was still alive. I hoped that all the missing women were alive. His harem, his odalisques, his collection of beautiful, special women. I shut off the motor and took a deep breath before I climbed out of the car. I walked quickly over the springy lawn in a crouch. I remembered something that Satchel Paige used to say. Keep the juices flowing by jangling around gently as you move. I was jangling. Shaped boxwoods and azaleas ran along the front of the house. A child's red bike with silver streamers on the handlebars lay on its side near the porch. Nice, I was thinking as I hurried along. Too nice. Casanova's child's bike. Casanova's respectable house in the suburbs. Casanova's fake, perfect life, his perfect disguise, his big, ugly joke on all of us, right in the city of Durham, his middle finger extended to the world. I carefully made my way around to the patio, which was built with white tile. It was bordered with the same brick as the house and the front walk. I noticed that creeping tendrils had invaded the red brick walls. Maybe he wasn't so perfect after all. I quickly crossed the patio, moving toward the Florida room. There was no turning back now. I had done a little breaking and entering in the name of duty before this. That didn't make it right, just easier. I broke a small window pane in a door and let myself in. Nothing, not a sound. I didn't think that Wick Sachs would have any use for an alarm system. I seriously doubted that he wanted the Durham police to investigate a breaking and entering. The first thing I noticed was the familiar cloying smell of lemon furniture polish. Respectability, civility, order. It was all a facade, a perfectly designed mask. I was inside the monster's house. Chapter 80. The house was as neat and orderly as the outside grounds, maybe even more so. Nice, nice, much too nice. I was nervous and afraid, but that didn't matter anymore. I was used to living with the feelings of fear and uncertainty. Carefully, I roamed from room to room. Nothing seemed out of place, even with two small children living there. Strange, strange, very strange. The house reminded me a little of Rudolph's apartment in Los Angeles. It was as if no one really lived there. Who are you? Show me who you really are, fucker. This house isn't the real you, is it? Does anyone know you without your masks? The gentleman does, doesn't he? The kitchen was right out of Country Living magazine. Antiques and other beautiful things were in almost every room. In a small study, the professor's notes and papers were strewn everywhere, covering every available surface. He's supposed to be very orderly and neat, I thought, and stored the conflicting data. Who was he? I was searching for something specific, but I didn't know exactly where to look. Down in the basement, I saw a heavy oak door. It was unlocked. It led into a small furnace room. I searched the room carefully. On the far side of the furnace room, I found another wooden door. It looked like a door to a closet, to some small, insignificant space. The second door was closed with a hook, which I removed as quietly as I could. I wondered if there could be more rooms in here, maybe an underground space, maybe the House of Horror, or a tunnel. I pushed open the wooden door, pitch blackness. I switched on the lights, and entered a single room that must have been 25 by 40. My heart skipped a beat. My knees got weak and I felt a little sick. There were no women in here, no harem. But I had found Wick Sax's fantasy room. It was right in his house, hidden in a secret corner of his basement. The room didn't fit in with the design of the rest of the house. He had built this room specially for himself. He liked to build things, to be creative, didn't he? The special room was laid out like a library. There was a heavy oak desk and two red leather club chairs were on either side of it. The four walls of bookcases were filled with books and magazines from floor to ceiling. My blood pressure must have soared 50 points. I tried to be still inside, but I couldn't. There was a collection of pornography and erotica, the most extraordinary I had ever seen or even heard described. There were at least 1,000 books in the room. I read titles as I quickly roamed from wall to wall, shelf to shelf. Strangest Sex Acts in Modes of Love of All Races, Illustrated Cherries, printed for the Erotica Biblion Society of New York. Humiliations of Anastasia and Pearl. The Harem Omnibus, a reader. Until She Screams. The Hymen, a medico-legal study in rape. I concentrated and tried to focus on what I needed to do here. First, I tried to quiet the roaring noise in my head. I wanted to leave Wick Sax a sign that I had been here, that I knew about his dirty little secret place, that he had no more secrets. I wanted him to experience the same kind of pressure, stress, and fear that all of us were going through. I wanted to hurt Dr. Wick Sax. I hated him beyond anything I could have imagined. On the desk was a copy of a pamphlet from a supplier of erotic books and magazines. Nicholas J. Soberhagen, 1115 Victory Boulevard, Staten Island, New York. By appointment. I made a quick note. I wanted to hurt Nicholas Soberhagen, too. Sax or someone else had checked off several books on the pamphlet's pages. I leafed quickly through it, reading with an ear cocked for sounds of a car on the street. Time was short now. The Special Orders of St. Teresa, not to be missed. This reprint of an extremely rare original edition was issued in the 1880s. Here are actual recollections on the proper use of the rod at a Spanish nunnery outside Madrid. The Love Master, lively sexual adventures of a dancer in Berlin, the various sex maniacs she encounters for every serious collector. Release, an interpretive first novel based on the actual and imagined life of the French serial murderer Guy Deray. I scanned the rows of wooden shelves directly behind the work desk. How long should I push my luck inside the house? It was getting late for Sax and his family to be out. I stopped at a shelf behind his chair. My heart tightened when I saw several books on Casanova. I read the titles under my breath. Memoirs by Casanova. K. Casanova, 102 Erotic Engravings, The Most Wonderful Nights of Love of Casanova. I thought of the two small children who lived in this house, Nathan and Faye Ann, and I felt badly for them. Their father, Dr. Wick Sachs, had his delirious evil fantasies in this room. Stimulated by his dirty books, his collection of erotica, he decided which fantasy to act out in real life, didn't he? I could feel Sachs's presence in this room. I was getting to know him, finally. Was it possible that he kept the women somewhere nearby? Somewhere in town, where we would never expect to look? Was that why none of the searches had uncovered the House of Horror? Was it somewhere right in suburban, highly respectable Durham? Was Naomi close by, waiting for someone to find her? The longer she was kept, the more dangerous her situation would become. I heard a noise upstairs and listened closely, but there was no other sound. It might have been an electrical appliance, or just the wind, or a loose part in my skull. It was past time to get out of the house. I hurried upstairs and back out across the patio. I had been tempted to draw a cross on the pamphlet on Sachs's desk to leave my mark. I resisted the impulse. He knew who I was. He had contacted me as soon as I arrived in Durham. But I was the one in heat now. I was back in my hotel room at a little past midnight. I felt empty and numb. Adrenaline was pumping through my body at a furious rate. The phone rang almost as soon as I walked in the door. A nasty, insistent hotel phone ring that demanded to be picked up. "Who the hell?" I muttered. I was half-crazed by now. I wanted to race out into the southern night to search helter-skelter for Naomi. I wanted to grab Dr. Wick Sachs and beat the truth out of him. Whatever it takes. "Yes, who is this?" I spoke a little too loudly into the phone. It was Kyle Craig. "Well," he began, "what did you find out?" Chapter 81. Morning had broken again. Nothing had really changed about the ghoulish investigation. Kate was still my partner in crime. That was her choice, but I approved. She knew Casanova better than the rest of us combined. She and I spied on the big, beautiful Sachs house from the triangle of dense fir woods off Old Chapel Hill Road. We had already seen Wick Sachs once that morning. Our lucky day. The beast was up bright and early. He was tall and professorial-looking, with sandy blonde hair brushed straight back and horn-rimmed glasses. He appeared to have a very good build. He had ventured out to the porch at around 7 to pick up the Durham paper. The headline read, "Casanova Watch Continues." The local newspaper editors could have had no idea, no clue, how accurate those words were. Sachs glanced at the front page, then casually folded it under his arm. Nothing of interest for him today. Another ho-hum day at the serial killer office. At a little before 8, he came out with his children in tow. He had a big, toothy smile turned on for the kids. The good father was taking them to school. His little boy and girl were outfitted, as if they belonged in the front window of Gap for Kids or Esprit. They looked like adorable little dolls. The FBI would follow Sachs and the children to the school. "Isn't this a little unusual, Alex? Two surveillance jobs in a row like this?" Kate asked me. She was analytical, and her mind never stopped working all the angles. She was as obsessive about the case as I was. That morning she was dressed down, as usual, tatty jeans, a navy blue t-shirt, sneakers. Her beauty shone through anyway. She couldn't hide it. "Investigations of repeat killers are almost always unusual. This one is stranger than most," I admitted. I talked about the twinning angle again. Two badly twisted men with no one to talk to share with. No one to understand until they met each other. Then a powerful connection between the two killers. Kate was a twin, but she'd experienced a benign form of twinning. With Casanova and the gentleman, it was something else. Wick Sachs came right back from the drop-off at school. We could hear him whistling cheerfully as he strolled to his perfect house. Kate and I had talked about the fact that he was a doctor after all, though a doctor of philosophy. Nothing much happened for the next few hours. There was no sign of Sachs or his wife, the lovely Mrs. Casanova. Wick Sachs left the house on the hill again at 11. He was blowing off his teaching classes today. He had already missed his 10 o'clock tutorial, according to the schedule I had from Dean Lowell. Why was that? What slick game was he playing now? There were two cars in the circular driveway. He chose the burgundy one, a Jaguar XJS convertible with a tan top, 12-cylinder engine. The other car was a black Mercedes sedan. Not too shabby on a professor's salary. He was heading out now, hitting the road. Was he going to visit his girls? Chapter 82. We followed Wick Sax's sporty Jaguar onto Old Chapel Hill Road. We eased through Hope Valley, passing very substantial houses that had been built in the 20s and 30s. Sax didn't seem to be in a hurry. So far, this was his game. We didn't know the rules or even what game he was playing. Casanova, the beast of the southeast. Kyle Craig was still working on a financial investigation of Sax with Internal Revenue. Kyle also had a half dozen agents, filling in all the dots that might connect Sax and Will Rudolph in the past. The two had definitely been classmates at Duke. High honor students, Phi Beta Kappa. They had known each other but weren't close friends in school. At least, they didn't seem to have been. Actually, Kyle had been at Duke then, too, in the law school. Phi Beta himself. When had the actual twinning taken place? How had the strong, freakish bond occurred? Something wasn't making sense to me about Rudolph and Sax yet. "What if he lets that XJS out?" Kate said as we discreetly followed the monster to what we hoped was his lair in the woods, his harem, his disappearing house. We were tailing Sax in my old Porsche. "I doubt he wants to draw a lot of attention to himself," I told her. Although the XJS and the Mercedes kind of worked against that theory. "Besides, a Jaguar isn't much of a test for a Porsche."
"Even a Porsche from another century?" Kate asked.
"Ho," I answered her. "Ho." Sax drove down Interstate 85, then turned on to 40. He got off at the exit for Chapel Hill. We followed him for another 2 miles through town. He finally stopped and parked near the University of North Carolina campus on Franklin Street.
"All of this is making me feel so weird, Alex. A professor at Duke University? A wife and 2 beautiful children, Kate said. "The night he grabbed me, he probably followed me off the campus. He watched me. I think he chose me right here."
I glanced over at Kate. "You okay?" I asked her. "Tell me if you're not up to this." Kate looked at me. Her eyes were intense, troubled.
"Let's get this the hell over with. Let's get him today. Deal?"
"Deal," I agreed.
"We've got you, butthead,"
Kate muttered into the car windshield. The quaint and pretty Chapel Hill Street was already busy at 11:45. College kids and profs were sliding in and out of the Carolina Coffee Shop, Pepper's Pizza, the newly rebuilt Intimate Bookstore. All the favorite Franklin Street haunts were doing a pretty good business. The college town atmosphere was appealing. It took me back to my days at Johns Hopkins, Cressmont Avenue in Baltimore. Kate and I were able to follow Wick Sax from about a block and a half away. It would be easy for him to lose us now, I knew. Would he run to the house in the woods? Would he go to see his girls? Was Naomi still there? He could easily duck into the record bar or into Spanky's restaurant on the corner, come out a side door and disappear. A game of cat and mouse had begun. His game, his rules. Always his rules so far. "He seems too smug, too self-satisfied," I said as we tailed along at a reasonable distance. He hadn't even turned to see if he was being followed. He looked like a tweedy, jaunty prof on a lunchtime errand. Maybe that was all this was. "You still okay?" I checked on Kate again. She was watching Sax, like a scrapyard dog with a grudge to settle. I remember that she took karate lessons somewhere near here in Chapel Hill.
"Mm-hmm. A lot of bad memories stirred up, though. Scene of the crime and all that," Kate muttered.
Wick Sax finally stopped in front of the nicely retro Varsity Theater in downtown Chapel Hill. He stood next to a community billboard covered with all sorts of handwritten notices and posters, mostly aimed at university students and faculty members.
"Why would that scum be going to a movie?"
Kate whispered, sounding more incensed than ever. "Maybe because he likes to escape, as in sublimate?" This is the secret life of Wick Sacks. We're watching it.
I'd kind of like to go after him right now. Rumble, Kate said.
Yeah, me too. Me too, Kate.
I had noticed the cluttered community billboard in one of my walks here before. There were several notices about missing persons in the Chapel Hill area. Missing students. All of them were women. It struck me that this was a cruel plague that had come to the community, and no one had been able to do anything to stop it. No one had the cure. Wick Sacks seemed to be waiting for something or somebody. Who the hell is he going to meet here in Chapel Hill? I muttered.
Will Rudolph?
Kate said without missing a beat.
His old school chum. His best friend.
I'd thought about Rudolph coming back to North Carolina, actually. Twinning could be an almost physical addiction. In its negative form, it was based on codependency or enabling behavior. The two of them abducted beautiful women and then tortured or killed them. Was that their shared secret? Or was there even more to it than that?
He looks like Casanova would look without the mask, Kate said.
We had slipped inside a small cutesy pie shop called School Kids.
He has the same color hair. But why wouldn't he disguise his hair, she muttered. Why only a mask?
Maybe the mask isn't a disguise at all. It might mean something different in his private fantasy world, I suggested. It's possible that Casanova is his real persona. The mask, the whole human sacrifice aura, the symbolism, all of that would be very important for him. Sacks was still waiting in front of the community billboard. Waiting for what? I had a gut feeling that something wasn't right with this picture. I sneaked a peek at him through the binoculars. His face was unconcerned, almost serene. A day in the park for the vampire Lestat. I wondered if he might be high on some kind of drug. He certainly knew about sophisticated tranquilizers. Behind him on the community board were all sorts of messages. I could read them with the binoculars. Missing, Carolyn Eileen DeVito. Missing, Robin Schwartz. Missing, Susan Pyle. Women for Jim Hunt for governor. Women for Lieutenant Governor Lori Garnier. The Mind Sirens at the Cave. All of a sudden, I had a possible answer. Messages. Casanova was sending out a cruel message for us. For anyone who was watching him. Anyone who dared to follow him. I slammed my hand down hard against the dusty windowsill inside the small store. The son of a bitch is playing mind games, I nearly shouted in the crowded shop where we were watching Wick Sacks. The elderly shopkeeper eyed me as if I were dangerous. I was dangerous.
What's wrong?
Kate was suddenly peering over my shoulder, leaning her body against me, trying to see whatever it was that I saw up the street.
It's the poster behind him. He's been standing under it for the past 10 minutes.
That's his message, Kate, to whoever's following him. That bright orange and yellow poster says it all. I handed her the binoculars. One poster on the bulletin board was larger and more prominent than the others. Kate read it out loud.
Women and children are starving. As you walk by with loose change in your pocket, please change your behavior now. You can actually save lives.
Chapter 83.
Oh, Jesus, Alex, Kate spoke in a tense whisper. If he can't go out to the house, they'll starve. And if he's followed, he won't go out to the house. That's what he's telling us. Women are starving. Change your behavior now.
I wanted to take out Wick Sacks right there. I knew there was nothing we could do to him. Nothing legal, anyway. Nothing sane.
Alex, look!
Kate sounded an alarm. She handed me the glasses. A woman had come up to Sacks. I squinted through the binoculars. The noonday sun was bright off shiny glass and metal surfaces up and down Franklin Street. The woman was slender and attractive, but she was older than the women who had been abducted. She had on a black silky blouse, tight black leather slacks, black shoes. She was carrying a briefcase loaded with books and papers.
She doesn't seem to fit his mold, his pattern, I said to Kate. She looks in her late 30s.
I know her. I know who she is, Alex, Kate whispered.
I looked at her.
Who, for God's sakes, Kate?
She's a professor in the English department. Her name is Suzanne Wellesley. Some of the students call her Runaround Sue.
There's a joke about Suzanne Wellesley throwing her underwear against the wall, and it sticks.
They could tell the same joke about Dr. Sachs, I said. He had a nasty reputation as a rake on campus. He'd had the bad rep for years, but no disciplinary action was ever taken. More perfect crimes? He and Ms. Suzanne Wellesley kissed in front of the Hunger billboard. A tongue kiss, I could see as I watched through the binoculars. A very hot embrace, too, with no apparent concern about the public venue. I had second thoughts about the message. Maybe it was just a coincidence, only I didn't believe in coincidences anymore. Maybe Suzanne Wellesley was involved with the house that Sachs kept. There could be others, too. Maybe this whole thing involved some kind of adult sex cult. I knew they existed. Even in our nation's capital, they existed and flourished. The two of them walked casually a short way down crowded Franklin Street, in no apparent hurry. They were headed in our direction. Then they stopped at the Varsity Theater ticket booth. They were holding hands, cute as could be.
"Damn him. He knows he's being watched," I said. "What is his game?"
"She's looking this way. Maybe she knows, too. Hello, Suzanne. What the hell are you up to, dragon lady?"
They bought movie tickets like any normal couple and went inside. The theater marquee advertised Roberto Benigni is Johnny Stecchino, riotous comedy. I wondered how Sachs could be in the mood for an Italian comedy. Was Casanova that cool? Yes, he probably was, especially if this was all part of some plan of his.
Is the movie marquee a message, too? What is he telling us, Alex?
That this is all a riotous comedy for him? It just might be, I said.
He does have a sense of humor, Alex. I can vouch for that. He was capable of laughing at his own bad jokes.
I called Kyle Craig from a payphone in a nearby Ben and Jerry's ice cream. I told him about the woman and children are starving poster. He allowed that it could be a message for us. Anything was possible with Casanova. When I came out of the store, Sachs and Suzanne Wellesley were still inside the Varsity Theater, presumably laughing riotously at the Italian actor Roberto Benigni. Well, perhaps Sachs was laughing at us. Women and children are starving. Just past 2:30, Sachs and Dr. Wellesley came out of the Varsity Theater. They strolled back to the corner of Franklin and Columbus. The half-block walk seemed to take 10 minutes. They ducked inside the ever-popular Spanky's, where they had a late lunch.
"Isn't this sweet? Young love," Kate said with a hiss in her voice. "Damn him. And damn her, too. Damn Spanky's for giving them food and grog."
They sat near the front window inside the restaurant, on purpose. They held hands at their table and kissed a few times. Casanova the lover? A lunchtime tryst with another professor? None of it made any sense yet. At 3:30, they left Spanky's restaurant and walked the half-block back to the message board. They kissed again, but this time with more restraint, and finally parted. Sachs drove back to his house in Hope Valley. Wick Sachs was definitely playing with us. His own game, for his own private pleasure. Rat and Cat. Chapter 84. Kate and I decided to have a late supper at a place called Frog and the Redneck in downtown Durham. She said we had to have a couple of hours break from the action. I knew she was right. Kate wanted to go home first, and asked me to call for her in a couple of hours. I wasn't prepared for the Kate who opened the door of her apartment. It wasn't Kate's usual bas couture look. She had on a beige linen sheath, with a flowered blouse worn as a jacket. Her long brown hair was tied back with a bright yellow scarf. "My Sunday go to eatin' clothes," Kate said, with a conspiratorial wink. "Except I can never afford to go out to eat on my post-med school budget. Occasionally KFC or Arby's."
"You have a hot date tonight?" I asked her in my usual kidding tone. I wondered who was kidding whom, though. She casually took my arm in the crook of hers.
"As a matter of fact, maybe I do. You look nice tonight. Very dashing, very cool."
I had abandoned my usual bas couture look, too. I'd decided on dashing and cool instead. I don't remember much about the car ride to the Durham restaurant, except that we talked all the way. We never had any trouble talking. I don't exactly remember the meal, except that it was very good, regional continental grub. I have the recollection of muscovy duck, of blueberries and plums in whipped cream. What I remember most clearly is Kate sitting with one arm propped on the table, her face resting easily on the back of her hand. A very nice picture portrait. I remember Kate taking off a yellow scarf at one point during dinner. "Too much," she said and grinned. "I have a new pet theory, theory du jour, about the two of us. I think it's right. Do you want to hear it?" she asked me. She was in a good mood in spite of the harrowing and frustrating investigation. We both were. "Nah," said the wise guy in me, the part afraid of too much in the way of emotions. Lately, anyway. Kate wisely ignored me and went on with her theory. "I'll start. Alex, we're both really, really afraid of attachments right now in our lives. That's obvious. We're both too afraid, I think." She was carefully leading the way. She sensed this was difficult territory for me, and she was right. I sighed. I didn't know if I wanted to get into any of this right now, but I plunged ahead. "Kate, I haven't told you much about Maria. We were very much in love when she died. It was like that between us for 6 years. This isn't selective memory on my part. I used to tell myself, 'God, I'm unbelievably lucky I found this person.' Maria felt the same way." I smiled. "Or so she told me. So, yes, I am afraid of attachments. Mostly I'm afraid of losing someone I love that much again." "I'm afraid of losing someone else too, Alex," Kate said in a soft voice. I could barely hear her words. Sometimes she seemed shy and it was touching. "There's a magical line in The Pawnbroker. Magical to me, anyway. Everything I loved was taken away from me, and I did not die." I took her hand and kissed it lightly. I felt an overwhelming tenderness toward Kate at that moment. "I know the line," I said. I could see anxiety in her dark brown eyes. Maybe we both needed to take this thing forward, whatever was beginning to happen between us, whatever the risks might be. "Can I tell you something else? One more true confession that doesn't come easily?" "This is a bad one," she said. "I want to hear it. Of course I do. Anything you want to tell me?" "I'm afraid I'm going to die just like my sisters, that I'll get cancer too. At my age, I'm a medical time bomb. Oh, Alex, I'm afraid to get close to someone and then get sick on them." Kate let out a long, deep breath. It was obviously a hard thing for her to say. We held hands for a long time in the restaurant. We sipped port wine. We were both a little quiet, letting powerful new feelings wash over us, getting used to them. After dinner, we went back to her apartment in Chapel Hill. The first thing I did was to check around for uninvited house guests. I had tried to talk her into a hotel room during the car ride, but as usual, Kate said no. I remained paranoid about Casanova and his games. "You're so damn stubborn," I told her, as we both checked all the doors and windows. "Fiercely independent is a much better description," Kate countered. "It comes with a black belt in karate, second degree. Watch yourself." "I am," I laughed. "I've also got 80 pounds on you." Kate shook her head. "Won't be enough." "You're probably right," I laughed out loud. No one was hiding in the apartment on Old Ladies Lane. No one was there except the two of us. Maybe that was the scariest thing of all. "Please don't run off now. Stay for a while, unless you want to or have to," Kate said to me. I was still standing in her kitchen. My hands were awkwardly jammed into my pockets. "I've got nowhere I'd rather be," I told her. I was feeling a little nervous and keyed up. "I have a bottle of Chateau de la Chaise. I think that's the name. It only cost $9, but it's decent wine. I bought it just for tonight, even though I didn't know it at the time." Kate smiled. 3 months ago, when I made the purchase." We sat on Kate's couch in the living room. The place was neat, but still funky. There were black and white photos on the walls of her sisters and her mother. Happier times for Kate. There was an amazing picture of her, in her pink uniform, at the big top truck stop where she worked to pay her way through school. The waitressing job was part of the reason medical school had meant so much to her. Maybe the wine made me tell Kate more about Jesse Flanagan than I wanted to. It had been my only attempt at a serious attachment since Maria's death. Kate told me about her friend Peter McGrath, history professor at the University of North Carolina. As she talked about Peter, I had the disturbing thought that maybe he was one suspect we had glossed over too quickly. I couldn't leave the case alone, not even for one night. Maybe I was just trying to escape into my work again. Still, I made a mental note to check out Dr. Peter McGrath a little more carefully. Kate leaned in close to me on the couch. We kissed. Our mouths made a perfect fit. We had both done this before, kissed, but maybe never as well.
"Will you stay tonight?"
"Please stay," Kate whispered.
"Just this one night, Alex. We don't have to be scared about this, do we?"
"No, we don't have to be scared," I whispered back. I felt like a schoolboy. Maybe that was okay, though. I didn't know exactly what to do next, how to touch Kate, what to say, what not to do. I listened to the soft hum of her breathing. I let everything take its natural course. We kissed again, as gently as I ever remember kissing anyone. We were both needy. But we were so vulnerable at that moment. Kate and I went to her room. We held each other for a long time. We talked in whispers. We slept together. We didn't make love that night. We were best friends. We didn't want to ruin it. Chapter 85. Naomi thought that she was finally losing the last pieces of her sanity. She had just seen Alex kill Casanova, even though she knew it hadn't really happened. She'd seen the shooting with her own eyes. She was hallucinating, and she couldn't stop the waves of delusion anymore. She talked to herself sometimes. The sound of her own voice was comforting. Naomi became quiet and thoughtful as she sat on an armchair in the darkened prison cell. Her violin was there, but she hadn't played it in days. She was afraid for a whole new reason now. Maybe he wasn't coming back again. Maybe Casanova had been caught and he wouldn't tell the police where he kept his captives. That was his ultimate leverage, wasn't it? That was his diabolical secret, his final edge and bargaining chip. Maybe he'd already been killed in a shootout. How could the police hope to find her and the others if he was dead? Something's happened, she thought. He hasn't been here in the last 2 days. Something has changed. She desperately wanted to see sunny blue skies, grass, the Gothic spires of the university, the layered terraces at the Sarah Duke Gardens, even the Potomac River in all of its muddy gray glory back home in Washington. She finally got up from the easy chair beside her bed. Very, very slowly, Naomi shuffled across the bare wooden floor and stood by the locked door with her cheek pressed against the cool wood. "Should I do this crazy thing?" she wondered. "Do I sign my own death warrant?" Naomi could barely catch her breath. She listened for sounds in the mysterious house, any tiny, insignificant sound at all. The rooms had been soundproof, but if you made enough noise, some sound carried through the eerie building. She went over what she wanted to say, exactly what she would say. "My name is Naomi Cross." "Where are you, Kristen? Green Eyes. I've decided that you're right. We have to do something. We have to do something together. He's not coming back." Naomi had thought this moment through clearly, intelligently, she hoped, but she couldn't say the words out loud. She understood that plotting against him could mean her death. Kristen Miles had called out to her a few times during the past 24 hours, but Naomi hadn't answered back. It was forbidden to talk, and she had seen his warning to them, the hanged woman a few days before. Poor Anna Miller, another law student. She couldn't hear anything right now. White noise, that was all. The static of silence, the gentle hum of eternity. There was never even the sound of a car, not a single backfire or a distant horn, not even the boom of an airplane passing overhead. Naomi had decided they must be underground, at least a couple of levels down into the earth. Had he built this underground complex, this Sinplex? Had he thought it all through, dreamed about it, and then done it in some burst of psychopathic fury and energy? She thought that he had indeed. She was getting herself ready to break the silence. She had to talk to Kristen, to Green Eyes. Her mouth was so dry, it felt like cotton wool. Naomi finally licked her lips.
"I would kill for a Coke. I would kill him for a Coke," she whispered to herself. "I could kill him, given the chance.
I could kill Casanova. I could commit a murder. I'm that far gone, aren't I?" she thought, and had to stifle a sob. Naomi finally called out in a loud, strong voice.
"Kristen! Can you hear me? Kristen! It's Naomi Cross!"
She was shivering, and warm tears streamed down her cheeks. She'd gone against him and his shitty, sacred rules. Green Eyes called back immediately. The other woman's voice sounded so good.
"I can hear you, Naomi. I think I'm only a few doors away from you. I hear you fine. Keep talking. I'm sure he's not here, Naomi."
Naomi didn't think any more about what she was doing. Maybe he wasn't there, maybe he was. It didn't matter now.
"He's going to kill us," she called back. "Something's different about him. He's going to kill us for sure. If we're going to do anything, we have to do it the first chance we get." "Naomi's right."
Kristen's voice was slightly muffled, as if she were talking from the bottom of a well.
"Do you all hear, Naomi? Of course you do. I have one idea for everyone to consider."
Naomi spoke even more loudly this time. She wanted to keep this communication going now. They all had to hear her, all the trapped women.
"The next time he gets us together, we have to go for it. If we rush him all at once, he might hurt some of us, but he can't stop all of us. What do you think?"
Just then, the heavy wooden door to Naomi's room opened a crack. Light streamed in. Naomi watched in stark horror as the door swung open. She couldn't move, couldn't speak a word. Her heart beat painfully in her chest, pounding, and she couldn't get a breath. She felt as if she were about to die. He'd been there, waiting, listening all this time. The door opened all the way.
"Hello. My name is Will Rudolph,"
the tall, good-looking man in the doorway said in a pleasant voice.
"I like your plan very much, but I don't think it will work. Let me tell you why."
Chapter 86. I was at Raleigh-Durham International Airport at a little before 9 on Wednesday morning. The cavalry was arriving. Fresh troops were here. Team Samson was back in town. In contrast to the creeping terror and paranoia that were present everywhere on the streets of Durham and Chapel Hill, the early morning business people at the airport seemed oblivious to harm in their dark-pressed suits, their floral print dresses from Neiman Marcus and Dillard. I like that. Good for them. Denial is an approach. I finally saw Samson loping through the U.S. air gate with long, determined strides. I waved my local newspaper at him. It was characteristic of me to wave and for Man Mountain not to. He gave a city cool head nod, though. Bad to the bone. Just what the doctor ordered. I brought Samson up to speed while we drove from the airport to Chapel Hill. I needed to check out the Waikagil River area. It was just another hunch of mine, but it could lead to something, like the location of the disappearing house. I had enlisted the help of Dr. Louis Freed, a mentor and former teacher of Seth Samuels. Dr. Freed was a noted black historian on the Civil War, a period I was also interested in. Slaves and the Civil War in North Carolina. In particular, the Underground Railroad that had been used for slaves escaping to the North. As we entered Chapel Hill, Samson got to see for himself what the abductions and grisly murders had done to the once peaceful college town. The nightmarish scene reminded me of a couple of my subway trips in New York City. It also reminded me a little of home, our nation's capital. The people of Chapel Hill now hurried along the picturesque streets with their heads down. They no longer made eye contact with one another, especially with strangers. Trust had been replaced by fear and terror. The sweet small townness had vanished.
"You think Casanova's enjoying this invasion of the body snatchers, Aura?" Sampson asked as we cruised the side streets bordering the University of North Carolina campus, former home base of Michael Jordan and too many other pro basketball stars to mention.
"I think he's learned to enjoy being a local celebrity, yes. He likes to play the game. He's especially proud of his handiwork, his art."
"Doesn't he want a larger venue? Larger canvas, so to speak?" Sampson asked as we climbed the gentle hills the college town had apparently been named for.
"I don't know about that yet. He might be a very territorial wreck killer. Some wrecks are strictly territorial. Richard Ramirez, the son of Sam, the Green River Killer." I then told Sampson about my theory on twinning. The more I thought about it, the sounder it got for me. Even the FBI was starting to believe in it a little. The two of them have to be sharing some big secret. That they abduct beautiful women is only part of it. One of them thinks of himself as a lover and artist. The other is a brutal killer. Much more typical of serial killer cases. They complete each other. They correct each other's weaknesses. Together, I think they're virtually unstoppable. More importantly, I think they do, too.
"Which one is the leader?" Sampson asked a very good question.
It was completely intuitive on his part, the way he always solves problems. "I think it's Casanova. He's definitely the more imaginative of the two. He's the one who hasn't made any major mistakes yet, either. But the gentleman isn't really comfortable being a follower. He probably moved to California to see if he could succeed on his own, and he couldn't."
"Is Casanova this kinky-ass college professor, Dr. Wick Sachs, the pornography professor you told me about? Is he our man, sugar?"
I peered across the front seat at Sampson. We were into the real deal now. Cop shop talk. "Sometimes I think it's Sachs, and that he's so goddamn clever and smart, he can let us know who he is. He enjoys watching us squirm. That could be the ultimate power game for him." Sampson nodded. One nod.
"And other times, Dr. Freud, what is your alternative thought process on Dr. Sachs?"
"Other times I wonder if Sachs has been set up. Casanova is very bright, and he's been extremely careful. He seems to send out misinformation that has everyone chasing his own tail. Even Kyle Craig's getting uptight and crazy." Sampson finally showed his large, very white teeth. Maybe it was a smile, or maybe he was going to bite me.
"Looks like I'm here just in the motherfucking nick of time."
As I slowed for a stop sign on the side street, a man with a gun suddenly moved away from a parked car and toward us. There was nothing I could do to stop him, nothing Sampson could do. The gunman pointed a Smith & Wesson right into my face, up against my cheekbone. Endgame, I thought. Tilt.
"Chapel Hill Police," the man shouted into the open window. "Get the hell out of the car. Assume the position."
Chapter 87. "You got here just in the nick of time," I muttered to Sampson under my breath. We climbed out of the car very slowly and carefully.
"Looks like it," he said. "Be cool now. Don't get a shot or beat up, Alex. I wouldn't appreciate the irony."
I thought I knew what was happening, and it made me incredibly angry. Sampson and I were suspects. Why were we suspects? Because we were a couple of black males riding on the side streets of Chapel Hill at 10 o'clock in the goddamn morning? I could tell that Sampson was furious, too, but he was angry in his own way. He was smiling thinly and shaking his head back and forth.
"This is rich," he said. "This is the best yet."
Another Chapel Hill detective appeared to assist his partner. They were tough-looking studs in their late 20s, longish hair, full mustaches, hard, muscular bodies from Workout Central. Nick Ruskin and Davy Sykes in training.
"You think this is funny?"
The second officer's voice was disembodied, so low I could barely hear the words.
"You think you're a laugh riot, home?"
he asked Sampson. He had a lead sap out and was holding it close to his hip, ready to strike.
"Best I could come up," Sampson said, keeping his smile turned on low. He wasn't afraid of saps.
My scalp was crawling, and sweat dribbled slowly down my back. I couldn't remember being rousted recently, and I didn't like it one bit. Everything bad I had felt since I'd been here fell into place. Not that rousting black males is peculiar to North Carolina or the South anymore. I started to tell the cops who we were. "My name is..." "Shut the fuck up, asshole!" One of them popped me in the small of the back before I could finish. Not hard enough to leave a bruise, but it stung like a good rabbit punch. It hurt in a couple of ways, actually.
"This one looks fucked up to me. Eyes are bloodshot," the low-voiced patrolman said to his partner. "This one is high."
He was talking about me. "I'm Alex Cross. I'm a police detective, you
motherfucker!"
I suddenly yelled at him. "I'm part of the Casanova investigation. Call Detectives Ruskin and Sykes right now. Call Kyle Craig from the FBI." At the same time, I spun around fast and hit the closest one in the throat. He dropped to the ground like a stone. His partner jumped forward, but Samson had him on the sidewalk before he could do anything too dumb. I took away the first stud's revolver easier than I could disarm a 14-year-old hugger-mugger in D.C.
"Assume the position," Samson said to his suspect.
There was no merriment in his deep voice.
"How many brothers you pull that shit on? How many young men you call homes and humiliate like that? Like you might fucking understand what their life is about. Makes me sick."
"You know damn well the serial killer Casanova isn't a black man," I said to the two disarmed Chapel Hill cops. "You haven't heard the last of this particular incident, gentlemen. Believe me on that one."
"There have been a lot of robberies in this neighborhood,"
the deep-voiced one said. He was contrite all of a sudden, doing the corporate America step and fetch it, the old two-step backstep.
"Save the sorry bullshit," Samson said, jabbing out with his own gun, letting the two detectives feel a little humiliation of their own.
Samson and I got back into our car. We kept the detectives' guns, souvenirs of our day, let them explain it to their bosses back at police headquarters.
"Son of a bitch," Samson said as we pulled away.
I hit the steering wheel with the heel of my palm. I hit it a second time. The bad scene had shaken me more than I had realized, or maybe I was just too ragged and frayed right then.
"On the other hand," Samson said, "we did take those boys down like snap. Little bullshit racism gets my adrenaline flowing, blood boiling. Gets the demons going. That's good. I have the proper edge now."
"It's nice to see your ugly face again," I said to Samson. I had to smile, finally. We both did. Then we were both laughing out loud in the car.
"Nice to see you too, brown sugar.
You'll be happy to know you've still got your looks. Strain's not showing too bad.
Let's go to work. You know, I pity that poor psycho if we catch him today. Which is likely, I might add."
Samson and I were twinning, too. It felt as good as ever. Chapter 88. Samson and I found Dean Browning Lowell working out at the new faculty gym in Allen Hall on the Duke campus. The gym was filled with the latest and greatest muscle building and toning equipment, shiny new rowing machines, stairmasters, treadmills, gravitrons. Dean Lowell was working with free weights. We needed to talk to him about Wick Sachs, doctor of pornography. Samson and I watched Browning Lowell do a tough set of lateral raises, then some leg curls and presses. It was an impressive workout, even by the standards of two dedicated gym rats like ourselves. Lowell was quite a physical specimen.
"So this is what an Olympian god looks like up close," I said as we finally strolled across the gym floor toward him.
Whitney Houston was playing from speakers in the gym's walls. Whitney was getting all the professor types pumped up to the max.
"You're walking with an Olympian god," Samson reminded me.
"It's easy to forget in the presence of the great yet humble ones," I said and grinned. Dean Lowell looked up as he heard our street shoes tattooing on the gymnasium floor. His smile was friendly and welcoming. That nice guy, Browning Lowell. Actually, he did seem like a nice man. He went out of his way to create that impression. I needed as much insider's detail as I could get from him in a hurry. Somewhere in North Carolina there had to be a missing puzzle piece that would begin to make sense out of all this murder and intrigue. I introduced Samson, and we skipped the polite small talk. I asked Lowell what he knew about Wick Sachs. The dean was extremely cooperative, as he'd been in our first meeting.
Sachs is our campus skell. Has been for a decade. Every university seems to have at least one,
Dean Lowell said and frowned deeply. I noticed that even his frown lines had muscles.
Sachs is widely known as Dr. Dirt. He's got tenure, though, and he's never been caught at anything completely untoward. I guess I should give Dr. Sachs the benefit of the doubt, but I won't.
You ever hear about an exotic book and film collection that he owns, keeps at his house? Pornography masquerading as erotica?
Samson decided to ask my next question for me. Lowell stopped his vigorous exercises. He looked at both of us for a long moment before he spoke again.
Is Dr. Sachs a serious suspect in the disappearances of these young women?
There are a lot of suspects, Dean Lowell. I can't say any more than that right now. I told him the truth. Lowell nodded.
I respect your judgment, Alex. Let me tell you some things about Sachs that might be important, he said.
He had stopped exercising by now.
He began toweling off his thick neck and shoulders. His body looked like polished rock.
Lowell continued to talk as he dried himself meticulously.
Let me start at the beginning. There was an infamous murder of a young couple here a while back. This was in 1981. Wick Sachs was an undergrad at the time, a liberal arts student, very brilliant mind. I was in the graduate school then. When I became dean, I learned that Sachs had actually been one of the suspects in the murder investigation, but he was definitely cleared. There wasn't any evidence that he was involved in any way. I don't know every detail, but you can check it for yourself with the Durham police. It was in the spring of 81. The murdered students were Roe Tierney and Tom Hutchinson. It was a huge scandal, I remember. In those days, a single murder case could still actually shock a community. Thing is, the case was never solved.
Why didn't you bring this up before? I asked Lowell.
The FBI knew all about it, Alex. I told them myself. I know that they talked to Dr. Sachs several weeks ago. It was my impression that he wasn't under suspicion and that they had decided there was no connection with the earlier murder case. I'm absolutely sure of it.
Fair enough, I said to the dean. I asked him for another big favor. Could he dredge up everything on Dr. Sachs that the FBI had originally requested? I also wanted to see the Duke yearbooks from the time when Sachs and Will Rudolph had both been students. I needed to do some important homework on the class of 81. Around 7 that night, Sampson and I met with the Durham police again. Detectives Ruskin and Sykes showed up, among others. They were feeling heavy-duty pressure, too. They pulled us aside before the update on the Casanova investigation. The stress had gotten to them, cooled their jets a little.
Listen, you two have worked big, bad cases like this before, Ruskin said.
As usual, he was doing most of the talking. Davy Sykes didn't seem to like us any better now than he had the first day we met.
I know that my partner and I got a little territorial at first. I want you to know, though, all we want to do is stop the killing now.
Sykes nodded his large, block-like head.
We want to nail Sachs. Trouble is, our brass has us chasing our tails as usual.
Ruskin smiled, and finally so did I.
We all understood departmental politics. I still didn't trust the Durham homicide detectives. I was certain they wanted to use Sampson and me, or at least keep us out of the way. Also, I had the feeling they were still holding evidence back. The Durham homicide detectives told us they were mired in an investigation of medical doctors in the research triangle, doctors with any kind of criminal record or associations. Wick Sachs was the chief suspect, but not the only one. There was still a strong chance that Casanova would turn out to be someone we hadn't even heard of. That was the way it often worked with repeat killer cases. He was out there, but we might have no idea who he really was. That was the scariest part of all, the most frustrating, too. Nick Ruskin and Sykes took Sampson and me over to the suspects board that had been put up. There were 17 names on it at this point. 5 were doctors. Kate had originally believed that Casanova was a doctor, and Kyle Craig did, too. I read off the doctors' names. Dr. Stefan Rahm, Dr. Francis Constantini,
Dr. Richard DeLallo, Dr. Miguel Fesco, Dr. Kelly Clark. I wondered again if several people could somehow be